welcome to the Dune Minute Podcast, your place to dive deep, minute by minute, into the cinematic adaptation of Frank Herbert's World of Dune. I'm one of your hosts, John.
And I am Zach.
And we are back. It's Tuesday now.
Tuesday.
And, well, Tuesday when this episode comes out. We are picking up...
It could be any day when they listen to this. It could be Monday. It could be Tuesday.
Are you going to list out every day of the week?
It could even be a Thursday. I doubt it will be a Wednesday.
If it's Wednesday, and you're listening to this.
Oh, brother. All right.
Yeah, we're picking up right where we left off with yesterday's episode, mm-hmm. mid-conversation between Stilgar and Jessica. We are in minute 21 through 22, and we start the minute off almost exactly at the minute mark with Jessica asking, "You believe in Paul?" And essentially we have a kind of slimmed down version of the conversation that we had only minutes ago that Stilgar had with the Elder Council, where he says, "There are signs, yes."
What a non-answer.
Jessica, in turn, "What if I would refuse?" And then this is a moment where it was definitely written as like a, let's break up this heavy moment with a little bit of comedy, where Stilgar's response is, "Well, then he's not Lisan al Gaib, and you have no purpose to serve. What else is there to do but then return your water to the well, huh?" And he does like a little mouth click between return your water to the well and huh.
He drives a hard bargain.
That line was felt so like Anton Chigurh to me.
Sure.
In the way that he delivered it.
Yep.
I just thought it was really funny.
Sure. Just matter of fact, there's cold, unfeeling.
It had the same feeling as the, well, then it's just a coin.
Yep.
Which it is.
Which it is. Yeah, exactly. Yep. Yeah, what a heck of an ultimatum, really.
It's basically, well, now you have to do this.
Yeah. They have options.
Sure.
You could do it and, fulfill this rite or fulfill this prophecy or whatever, or you could die. Your choice.
Whichever one sounds better to you.
Yeah. It literally does not matter to Stilgar.
Yeah, because it's not like Paul and Jessica are going to be able to fight their way out of Siege Tabor.
No. No, absolutely not.
Paul, as good of a fighter as he is.
Nah.
As mediocre of a fighter as he is.
Yeah. Well, there's just too many of them, you know?
Yeah.
So they can't, they're not going to beat the numbers. If they were to try to escape the siege, they ain't getting out.
No.
So we get to see the back half of this conversation, not between Stilgar and Jessica, but between Jessica and Paul.
Well, it's PB&J time.
PB&J time.
we cut to them putting on their still suits. Paul asks if it's an honor, and he feels that his mother should be honored, to which Jessica immediately is like, "I mean, it's either this or I'm dead." So, yeah. You know,
she basically says, "No, really, dude, it's an ultimatum."
Yeah. "Sorry if I don't feel super honored about this," or whatever. And then we get a little bit of insight into what Reverend Mothership is like on other planets, because Jessica says that she's not aware of how it works on Arrakis, but it varies mm-hmm. from culture to culture. And I think, hindsight after having seen Rossic poison mm-hmm. and everything in the quote unquote traditional way of becoming a Reverend Mother.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's
from Dune Prophecy.
Yeah, from Dune Prophecy. I think that is the method that Jessica is obviously most familiar with. Because
sure.
To say that she probably hasn't witnessed it before is probably not correct.
She's seen it before. She knows what goes into it, or at least has studied the process before. Yeah. Do you think she studied on Wallach 9?
I would assume so.
I've never really thought about that.
I would assume that all Bene Gesserit acolytes are initiated on Wallach 9 and they undergo a certain amount of training there. And then, at one point, Jessica was found to be the appropriate match for Leto. And then they went and did
the bone down.
Yeah. And then we have Paul.
There we go. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Not relevant to anything. Just wondered.
Yeah.
So Paul says to Jessica, "You're afraid," which is almost like half statement, half question.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, "Well, fucking yeah."
She's like, "Yeah. Also, this is lethal for men. So, you know, there's also that."
Does she say the...
Nope, that's the next minute. "You're afraid." Paul says, "You're afraid." Jessica's response is, "Reverend mothers are tasked with holding the memories of all reverend mothers before them, so I'll be given centuries of..."
Centuries of end. What?
"A minute to end."
Centuries of ending minutes in the middle of fucking sentences.
We gave a lot of praise to the editors for part one.
Yeah, well.
So far, the editors in part two are doing about as well as the Braves are this year.
Oh no, baseball's coming back.
It's always gonna.
All right, I got a couple things to talk about from the book.
Yeah.
And it is not about anything that we see on screen.
Yet. Okay.
So we are missing an important chapter in the book. Right here.
Okay.
So after the water ceremony or the Jameis water
burial,
whatever you want to call it
thing.
And before they discuss the Reverend Motherhood of Jessica,
mm-hmm.
there is a portion of the book where we get to meet, I guess, Paul's new wife, technically.
Yeah, because he does well, also... in addition to Jameis's water tokens,
yeah,
acquire a wife and children.
Yeah. So, very important character, plays a fairly big role in the books, is Hera, H-A-R-A-H, and her kids.
Yep.
We also get to learn about Chani's parentage, which is something completely left out of the movie here. So we get the, first, I'll talk about Chani. It's revealed in kind of an unceremonious way that Chani is the daughter of Liet Kynes.
Who in the books is a man, but yep. in the movies is a woman.
Correct.
Liet Kynes, as we discussed in season one, unfortunately was stabbed by Sardaukar mm-hmm. and thumped herself to death. we yes. also discussed what happened to Liet Kynes before.
Yeah.
But as a quick refresher, that is not how Liet Kynes dies in the books. Liet Kynes, I believe, is still alive. Nope. Okay. Liet Kynes has a very different fate in the books
yeah.
than Liet Kynes in the movies does.
Yeah. He gets captured by the Harkonnens, questioned, and they leave him to die in the desert.
Without a still suit.
Without a still suit. And he finds, or he starts hallucinating. He sees his father. It's a very moving, great passage in the book. Eventually, collapses, still alive, collapses on top of a spice blow and is exploded by spice.
Hey, what a way to go.
Yeah. It's a very fitting way for him to go. So Chani is just now learning of her father's death.
Yeah.
And again, they don't give a lot of time to really sit in this. We just hear someone say like, "Oh, poor Chani," and then she, you know, figures it out, and that's when Paul's kind of watching this from a distance, and he puts all the pieces together, and he realizes that Liet, which is the person that or how he goes by in the Fremen cultures, that's his Fremen name, and Kynes, Dr. Kynes, who he knows him as, they are one and the same person.
Yep.
So it all comes together for him here. And then we move off. We move away from that topic pretty quickly after this, because Paul is then introduced to Hera. Now, Hera is Jameis's former wife and was the former wife of Jeff, spelled G-E-O-F-F.
Yeah. Jameis and Jeff.
Jameis and Jeff. Yep. And we're introduced to in name. We haven't met them in person just yet, but Jameis's children. The oldest being named Khalif, which is 10 years old,
mm-hmm.
Technically a stepson because he was Jeff's son.
Yep.
and this is the great name, Orlop. O-R-L-O-P. It was an 8-year-old boy.
The 60s were a fantastic time.
So they have Khalif and Orlop are now technically Paul's kids.
Surprise.
Yep. So I guess in Fremen culture, if you kill someone and they have a spouse, and I guess I'll limit it to wife. I don't think it goes the other direction.
Maybe.
With as patriarchal as the Fremen seem to be, I don't think so.
Are they?
I'm going to take that back. You know, I think I'm wrong there.
Yeah, because
they have the Reverend Mothers.
They have the Reverend Mothers. Women are fedaiken. Like,
okay, yeah, I'm taking that back.
Yeah, it seems very equitable.
Well, no, I'm not. I'm actually not going to take it back because the rest of this conversation leads you to kind of believe that the wife, if they don't hold a place of like maybe fedaiken or in the religious sect, they are almost treated like property. Because, so Paul is given the option here. He's bested Jaimus, so he has the option of either marrying or making Hera his wife or making her his servant. That's the options.
Oof.
Yeah, not a great look.
Yeah. That's the 60s, baby.
Yeah, so he does not want to marry her.
Yeah.
So he makes her his servant.
Yeah.
Now the one, I guess, silver lining to this is that he has a year to change his mind before she's effectively back on the market. She can marry someone else at that point. She takes this, him making her his servant as a, you're too old kind of comment. Because at one point she says, I know I'm a little bit older, but I still, you know, people still say I have the beauty of my youth. And then he makes the decision to, you know, be the servant. And then she starts to repeat, but I'm young, but I'm young. So she is not thrilled with that decision. She wouldn't be thrilled with any decision.
Yeah.
When she first meets him, the very first words that she says to Paul is, this bested my Jaimus. Talking about how
this skinny ass boy
kind of, yeah. And yeah. The next line is my children made fatherless by another child. And that's when Stilgar asks Paul how old he is. And he says 15 standard years, yada, yada. So she gets over it. Paul uses some like voice light work on her to get her to calm down. And he asked her to show him his quarters, basically, like where they live.
Yeah.
Now this is the main point that I think Hera serves in this portion of the book. And it's really for the readers to understand how a siege works. So she goes into exposition mode and she is talking about how they're still holding classes for the children. They are, you know, continuing to go about day-to-day life, even though they are effectively getting ready to abandon the siege.
Yeah.
I feel okay with talking about this because this is not really a plot point in the movie. Yeah. So we're not going to get to it.
They don't really, I mean, they do and they don't. It's a lot of visual storytelling, I think, in how the siege works in the movie. And we'll get to those later.
Yeah, much later. But in the books, they are like gearing up to abandon this siege because they know that the Harkonnens are looking for them still.
Yeah. It's only a matter of time.
Yeah, exactly. So, but even with preparations for abandonment or to flee, as she puts it, they are still creating things out of plastics. They're still manufacturing. They're still teaching. They're still going about daily life because that is what Pardo Kynes and Liet Kynes told them to do. They said, you must never stop working. Yeah. One thing that is specifically called out, and they spend a fair amount of time talking about it, is dew collectors. Paul asked about them, and because Hera points them out that they're still manufacturing dew collectors.
Dew being D-E-W.
D-E-W, yes. Yeah. Or dew precipitators. So the wiki, Dune Wiki, says that they are smooth chromoplastic ovals, which were placed over the pit containing the plant's roots. During the day, the chromoplastic was gleaming white and could be seen if you're looking at it from an aerial view. But at night, they turned transparent. during this shift, it cools down rapidly.
Yeah.
And causes the surrounding air to condense, and the moisture is then trickled down to the roots and into the cistern. What the roots don't need, this gets deposited into the cistern. Along with the wind traps, the dew collectors were the most important tools for collecting atmospheric moisture on Arrakis. It goes on to say that they were introduced to Arrakis by Partokines. They were invented by Bajit Narayam, who lived from 7,520 to 7,613 AG, I have to assume.
Sure.
Used on many dry and low precipitation planets, and I wanted to read these names. New Bhutan.
Okay.
Deville, which is just devil with an extra I.
Yep.
And Seleucus Secundus.
So, second salsa.
Second salsa. So those are dew collectors. He spends a lot of time talking about them, so I figured we should also spend a fair amount of time talking about them.
Shout out to the encyclopedia.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, and that is, you know, Hera's place in this book. And I'm a little sad that we didn't see her in the movie. I completely understand why. That is so tangential to the story that they're telling.
Yeah.
They got a lot of material to get through. I get it. It was always going to be cut out in my mind, but it's still a pretty important scene in the book.
Don't worry. It's not the thing that they cut out that's going to piss you off the most.
No, it's not. We'll get there.
We'll get there later. Okay.
So that is all the book notes that I had.
Yeah, and we were left off mid-sentence. Once again, mm-hmm. Reverend Mothers are tasked with holding the memories of all the Reverend Mothers before them, so I'll be given centuries of...
That's it.
You'll have to come back tomorrow to find out what she's given centuries of. As always, you can find us online. We are available on Blue Sky at DuneMinute.com. You can email DuneMinute@gmail.com. All of our episodes are available on YouTube as well, if that's where you prefer to get your podcasts. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please feel free to rate and share the show with your friends. We'll see you tomorrow for another episode.
See ya.